The I word is in the air, also from the president himself. So if that, then economically, what? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, the 23rd day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I'm going to play you a quick clip from that interview President Trump did yesterday, the one that aired on Fox News this morning, and then we're going to talk about it a little bit. Here you go.
I'll tell you what, if I ever got impeached, I think the market would crash. I think everybody would be very poor.
Let us just for this moment sidestep Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution of the United States. That's where impeachment is. And instead talk about the second half of that cut, the crash poor part. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is on it.
Even for a president who's known to exaggerate, the idea that the strength of the economy is directly linked to him, that's a stretch, says Alan Blinder, an economics professor at Princeton. But
it would be unfair to give zero credit to President Trump for the strong growth of the economy in the last year or so, or since the tax cut.
Blinder co-authored a book on how presidents influence the economy, and he's very skeptical that markets would crash if Trump were to be impeached, even if they did.
We will not all be poor if the stock market crashes. Most Americans have very little stake in the stock market.
Because, as we like to say at Marketplace, the market is not the economy. And Charles Tien, a political science professor at Hunter College, points out the economy doesn't like to hurry.
I don't think the broader economy, whether it be unemployment, whether it be growth, can turn on a dime to events like impeachment. And impeachment usually happens over a number of months.
Still, during Watergate, when the threat of impeachment was swirling around Richard Nixon, markets took a dive. But with Clinton's impeachment, not so much. In both cases, other factors in the economy were also at work. Nixon's troubles came during a bear market. Clinton was in hot water during the dot-com boom.
It's not the presence of one person in the Oval Office that can make a market go up or down.
At least, that's been the case so far. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This is day four of the hearings into the next round of possible tariffs on Chinese imports. This batch would be the biggie, a 25% tax on $200 billion worth of goods. Joel Salto is among those testifying to the U.S. Trade Representative today. She's the CEO of Joann Stores, the craft supply people. And if you happen to be a Joann customer, you might already know that Salto is testifying because you might have gotten an email from the company asking you to sign a petition opposing the tariffs. Joel, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Kai.
We were intrigued by this idea you had of urging your customers to get involved in this tariff discussion. Tell me how you came to the decision to involve your customers.
Well, certainly when we read this newly released list of tariffs, we kind of wondered how did fabric and yarn end up on a list that was more of a high-tech debate with China's focus on 2025. And who better to create the awareness and express their passion about what they do every day with these raw materials that we import from China into the U.S. than our own customer base?
You get any pushback from those customers? I mean, some of them may be Trump supporters. They may be supporters of these tariffs.
Well, we have heard from tens of thousands of customers through the coalition MadeInAmericaTax.com. They are very supportive of it. And this is not a political statement on behalf of Joann. This is very nonpartisan. This is creating the awareness that this could actually hurt products that are made in America, because everything that our customers make with the products they buy from Joann that are imported from China are, in fact, made in America.
With these tariffs, the theory is, of course, that they will protect Americans and American businesses. You've got a whole bunch of small businesses, though, that are your clients and your customers. What do you tell those people who buy from you about these tariffs? Because my guess is you're going to pass on the costs, right?
Well, we are very concerned about our customers who are entrepreneurs and small business people. Over 20% of our customer base fall into that category. We are going to do everything in our power to manage through these increases should the tariffs pass. But it's likely, based on the sheer magnitude of them, that we will have to pass on some cost increases to them. We are concerned because their customers will then have the option of choosing a foreign-made product that's imported into the United States that doesn't have the similar tax on it.
Well, so that's where I was going to go next, which is China is certainly a source for a lot of fabrics and those kinds of items that come into this economy. Where else are you going to go so that you can supply your customers?
Well, we are looking at every possibility. If I use the example of fleece fabric, this is a fabric. We sell 40 million yards of fleece fabric every single year.
Fleece like they make like those fleecy jacket things or what?
The fleecy jackets, okay. the blankets. I think every youngster under the age of 15 has probably made a tie blanket in their life. And there's very few factories that can make this fabric, especially to meet our quality requirements as well as our cost requirements and the quantity that we need. It would be 18 months minimum for someone to set up a factory in order to make the fleece. I would say it would be maybe inside of a decade that someone could get to that scale.
Jill Salto, Joanne Storrs. Thanks very much, Jill. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai. Thank you.
With a new round of tariffs having kicked in last night and that $200 billion package looming, today does seem a day where the answer to the question, are we in a trade war, is pretty obvious. But if you're a little lost on how we got here and how you might feel the effects of those tariffs, the now what, if you will, check out our new thing. It's arewe in a trade war.com. Let me give it to you one more time. arewe in a trade war.com. All kinds of cool information there, an awesome timeline as well. The answer, by the way, is yes. Wall Street today, decidedly meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Since the Syrian civil war started 7.5 years ago, more than 3 million Syrians have crossed the border north into Turkey. They've had to restart their lives, find new jobs, and build new homes. And in a lot of cases, that falls on women, often young women, who've had to take on more responsibility than they ever anticipated because their husbands were killed in the war. Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports now from Gaziantep, Turkey, not far from the Syrian border, on a young woman who's become her family's breadwinner.
Amna Hafiz will never forget her first day at her first real job. She was 34 and really nervous, so nervous that she asked her mom to come with her. The day didn't get off to a great start. We got lost on the way there, she tells me in Arabic. That's because they didn't understand the bus system and walked instead. Hafiz was an hour late, and her boss, also a Syrian refugee, was not sympathetic.
He said, don't be late again or tell me that you got lost. And I said, no, of course not. So the next day, I gathered up all my strength, and when I got to work on time, I felt so relieved.
Her job cleaning the offices of a small nonprofit was easy enough. The hard part was being in an office. Hafiz says she was so shy it took her weeks to look people in the eye. Back in Syria, Hafiz had stayed at home with her two girls while her husband went to work. But when the government started bombing Aleppo, she fled and her husband stayed to fight. She found out later on TV he'd been killed, leaving Hafiz a young widow in a foreign country where she didn't speak the language.
Never in my life did I think I'd work, but I didn't want my daughters to have to rely on anyone else or to feel like something was missing without a father around.
It's been 2 years since that scary first day, she tells me as she washes the dishes and sweeps the floor in the office kitchen.
I'm so happy to work. And the most important thing for me is that I'm not dependent on anyone's help. I can take care of myself.
And that's Hafiz's cell phone, her 11-year-old daughter, Maryam, again.
Hello? Hello?
I ask her in Arabic, does she call you a lot at work?
She's always calling me. She always says, when are you coming home? You're late. I'm bored.
It's summer. School's out. Hafiz says she feels guilty she's not at home more, but she also knows she's one of the lucky ones. There are thousands of Syrian women like Hafiz in Turkey. Their husbands are gone, and they're carrying the weight of their families. Many have little education and few skills and can only get menial jobs with long hours and low pay. Hafiz got her job with the help of a local NGO and makes $500 a month. That first paycheck, she says, felt unreal.
That was the first time I ever got paid $500. I didn't even know what $500 meant. Right away, I took my daughters to the mall. I bought them food and they pushed the cart. It was the first time ever pushing a cart and they were so excited.
After work, Hafiz takes me to her apartment in Gaziantep, where about a quarter of residents are Syrian refugees. She lives on the second floor of an old building in a three-bedroom that she shares with her daughter, her mom, her dad, her three brothers, and two of their wives. Black cushions are spread out on the living room floor. Tonight, they'll be pulled together as beds. Her father sits quietly eating sunflower seeds. Her mother greets me warmly. We exchange hellos in Arabic.
Wa'alaikum salam, kayfik?
She tells me that back in Syria, they didn't live like this. Everyone had their own apartment. There was no better life than before, she says. We wish we can return to that life, but it won't come back. Things have gotten better here. When they first came to Turkey, after spending almost all their money on smuggling fees, Hafiz would spend her days outside a mosque, begging for bread. Even though she earns a lot more now and is paid in dollars, it's not enough to support her whole family. Her brothers work seasonal textile jobs, so they're unemployed a lot of the time. One of them, Mohammed, keeps himself busy by watching old horror movies. He pulls up a favorite on YouTube.
Hi, I'm Chucky. Wanna play?
It's a nice story, he says. In another room, Hafiz's daughter, Meryem, is glued to a Turkish soap opera. She's wearing a jeweled jean jacket and has green braces, which her mom pays off monthly. Meryem says these soap operas help her learn Turkish. She also tells me she wants to be a doctor.
A doctor?
Hafiz is glad to hear that. She wants Meryem to have a better life and to be independent. And she worries a lot about what would happen if she lost her job. Her fears even keep her up at night sometimes. But she still gets up early. Can't be late for work. In Gaziantep, I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Rima's reporting was made possible for us by the International Center for Journalists' Bringing Home the World Fellowship. Stipulation number one for this next story is that the healthcare industry is complicated. Stipulation number two is that the healthcare industry is a business, a very big business. Those two stipulations will come together tomorrow when shareholders of Cigna, the big insurance company, and Express Scripts, which is something called a pharmacy benefit manager, shareholders are going to vote on a $54 billion merger. Insurance company, you could probably figure out, right? Pharmacy benefit manager, PBM sometimes? Maybe not, even though they are a big cog in the healthcare business model. Fortunately for us, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein from the help desk at WHYY put together an explainer.
A PBM's most important job is to haggle with big pharma to get the lowest possible prices for prescription drugs. Insurers and big employers who run their own insurance plans don't want to do that, so they line up to hire PBMs as a go-between. University of Pennsylvania economist Ashley Swanson says you can think of PBMs like real estate agents.
They're doing a lot of complicated stuff, acting as an intermediary and performing all of these services. And the idea is they do it a lot, so they're going to be good at it.
These companies started modestly in the 1960s, but have grown into a $450 billion industry today. An industry that serves more than 250 million Americans. Northwestern economist Craig Garthwaite says PBMs have succeeded because they're pretty good at mixing it up with the drug companies.
If you or I decide we're going to go to Pfizer and say, I'd like to pay less for the drug, Pfizer's going to tell you to go pound sand.
Pfizer wouldn't say that to big PBMs like Express Scripts or CVS or even smaller players because PBMs draw negotiating power by pooling all their customers together. But size is just part of the equation.
In order to get pharmaceutical manufacturers to cut a deal on price, you have to be able to say no.
University of Pennsylvania's Ashley Swanson says the secret to securing rock-bottom prices comes from PBMs creating a list of drugs they will cover. What's called a formulary. If a PBM doesn't get a good price, it will keep it off its list, which means a person can get his or her medicine only by paying full price. To have access to a PBM's consumers, USC economist Jeffrey Joy says drug makers often agree to steep discounts.
That price competition, in theory, is good. In theory, it can save consumers money.
But here's the thing. Contracts between PBMs and drug makers are secret.
No one really knows how badly they're getting ripped off. No one knows what type of a rebate the PBM got.
So those who hire PBMs are kind of in the dark. They don't know how much of the money that PBMs wrestle away from drug companies gets passed on to the insurers and the employers, and how much the PBMs keep for themselves. Research firm IBIS World says the industry earned $19.5 billion in profits last year. Critics say profits like that show PBMs are putting their clients second. But Sharon Frazee with the Pharmacy Benefit Management Institute, which represents PBMs, says those same industry profits prove PBMs are playing a critical role in keeping drug costs in check.
People could go contract directly with manufacturers, but that almost never happens because I think there's value seen in the expertise that PBMs bring to the marketplace.
As drug prices continue to climb, more and more people are troubled by PBMs' business practices, wondering how much these middlemen are lowering drug spending or just padding their own pockets. And that threatens the profits for this industry. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We just really haven't felt included and got the shine that I think that we deserve.
On a lot of magazine covers, but not really in Power, African Americans and the fashion industry straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 76 points today, 0.3%, 25,656. NASDAQ down 10, that's 0.1%, 78.78. The S&P 500 off 4 points, 0.1% there as well, 28.56. Then a new round of tariffs rattled some manufacturing material stocks. Mining company Freeport-McMoRan declined 0.2% today. Southern Copper also lost about 0.2%. The maker of pressed ham in a metal can, Hormel, said tariffs on pork, aluminum, and steel will hurt its profits. Hormel sank 3% today. Poultry producer Sanderson Farms said pretty much the same thing about tariffs. Declined 0.2%. That's chicken. Bonds were unchanged. Yield on the 10-year T-note steady at 2.82%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. After 14 billion years and what will wind up being 12 television seasons, CBS said this week its hit sitcom The Big Bang Theory is going to come to an end after this coming season. But the end of original production doesn't mean Sheldon and the gang are going to disappear. The show's already been in syndication for 8 years now and will be for a very long time to come, because even with all the changes in small screen entertainment of late, that rerun Life After Death thing can still mean big money for the right kind of show. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that one.
Two cops get out of a squad car, flash their badges, and approach a dead body.
Drive!
Olivia Benson!
Elliot Stabler!
Benson and Stabler of Law & Order fame. Oh, the hours we've spent together.
Properties like Law & Order, they have massive number of episodes, really well-established brand, and a really wide-ranging appeal.
And those shows are syndication gold, says Dave Morgan. He's CEO of Simulmedia, a tech company that helps TV networks promote their shows. Think Seinfeld, Friends, or even old favorites like MASH and Happy Days. Those shows are ripe for syndication because their humor appeals to both kids and adults, and you can watch the episodes out of order, over and over.
Most people probably think the money is made as a show is airing when it's hot, and that's not the case.
In fact, it can take years for a show to pay for itself. Reruns equal revenue.
It's all about owning that intellectual property that you can sell again and again and again.
Amanda Lotz is a professor of media studies at the University of Michigan. She says the syndication market is changing, with Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, and TV networks investing big in original programming. People just aren't tuning into reruns the way they used to.
Now in an era where we have more and more niche hits, you just don't see the same kind of payout.
Lotz says The Big Bang Theory may be the last of a dying breed, a huge TV hit that lives on and on and on in syndication. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There's a piece in The Cut, that's New York Magazine's website for women, that's a fashion story, but not really a fashion story. It's about African Americans in that business. There are, relatively speaking, a lot of black models on magazine covers this fall. But behind the scenes, among the people deciding who gets on those covers, there aren't a whole lot of African Americans at all. Lindsay Peoples-Wagner is the fashion editor of The Cut. She wrote the piece. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
There are, in this piece, in The Cut, there are a bunch of thumbnails of magazine, fall magazine covers, bunch of African-American women, but that's not what we're talking about here, right? We're not talking about the face of it as much as the power structure behind it, right?
Right, right. I think it's, I mean, it's interesting that there's like 16 or 17 covers right now of black women on all of these magazines, but a lot of the magazines that have done that have historically been very exclusive and not inclusive of black women. And I think those magazines definitely now see like, hey, we have to get on this trend. People are asking for diversity. And so they do that. But when you look behind the scenes of the staff for these magazines, the people that are creating that content, there are very few people of color. And so it just begs the question of, is this, you know, or do you really care? Do you really want diversity, or is this just a fad?
So the piece, we should say, consists of a bunch of quotes, paragraph-ish or so, from some of the power players in fashion who happen to be black. And there are a bunch that I want to read for you. One is from Gabby Prescott. She's fashion editor at Bustle. Mm-hmm. And she says this: "We're trained and conditioned that there can only be one. So you see other black women as being in direct competition with you instead of thinking, you know, let me go talk to her. Maybe we can help each other out." This idea that there are so few that everybody's a competitor.
It's always been my experience in fashion personally that you just wait to see if someone wants to be, you know, open to you. It's already a competitive industry. Mm. And that, I think, just raises the stakes. But I think when there's so few black women, you know, you're fully aware that you're feeling this quote-unquote black slot for a lot of publications. You're fully aware that, like, they want you to be there for certain reasons, whether it be, you know, to make them look good, to, like, cover some black girl column. You know that you're there for a reason. And I think a lot of times it's hard because we have then started to believe that there can only be a few of us in the room and that there can only be a few of us with a seat at the table. So then we don't, in the end, want to really help each other a lot of times.
There are practical realities here, too, of being a black woman in fashion. A couple of these folks that you quote talk about white makeup staffs not having the right kind of makeup or not knowing what to do with black hair. There's a woman here who lost a job because of her hair.
It's just astounding because it's a lot of the big luxury brands. It's not just, you know, oh, I'm doing, you know, a shoot for a small catalog in the Midwest. It's these big brands that everyone is buying and supporting that still don't make sure that black women are really represented, taken care of. I mean, there's just no excuse for makeup artists still coming on set today and saying, oh, I don't want to carry enough colors in my makeup kit because it's too heavy. That's just not okay.
You talk to 100-ish people, right? Black people in fashion behind the scenes.
140, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess that's where the more than 100 comes from in the piece. What surprised you?
I think how emotional everybody got. A lot of people cried. Honestly, I felt like I needed to go to therapy after because I think, you know, we're all, it's, you know, grown men and women. A lot of the people are a lot older than me and have had a lot more experience, and I have so much respect for them. And I think when you, you know, when you hear people cry on the phone and talk about them just not really wanting to be in this anymore and being really discouraged, I don't know. It's really disappointing and it's upsetting. And I've never heard that many people cry before.
Lindsay Peoples-Wagner, fashion editor at New York Magazine and The Cut. Lindsay, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, which I should preface by saying that I have a rule, and it goes like this. You can say anything you want on the radio one time. Think about it. All right. So anyway, this might be that one time. This item today, another from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, Procter & Gamble, the consumer goods giant, has filed a trademark application for the phrase, or acronym more properly, I suppose, WTF. Also, FML, LOL, and NBD. They want to use them for cleaning and air freshening products, apparently. And yes, I am totally serious. All right, we got to go. But before we do, let me give you that URL for that cool thing we're doing. It's areweinatradewar.com. Areweinatradewar.com. Check it out. Dow Industrials off 76 today. The NASDAQ down 10. The S&P 500 off 4 points. That's like a 10%, 0.3%, whatevs. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Devke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.